even with the devaluation of whiteness sitting in Arkansas, I'm sure you must realize that there are certain privileges still attached to having a color devoid epidermis.
Just a Life podcast. Today, my guest is Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn holds the Morris Professorship for History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. I guess today's theme is kind of exploring America's creation story. And the book that we're going to discuss is The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origin of the United States of America. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
I guess first of all, to start off, I guess I want to ask the obvious question of what exactly is the counter-revolution of 1776?
Well, the argument in this book is that what drove the rebels led by George Washington to revolt against British rule per July 4th, 1776, was the historical reaction in North America to Somerset's case in 1772 in London, which abolished slavery in England, and was felt that that decision would leapfrog the Atlantic, thereby jeopardizing fortunes in North America based on the property and enslaved Africans. Secondly, there was the reaction to the Royal Proclamation of 1763, in which London was seeking to restrain the settlers, led by real estate speculator number one, George Washington, from moving west, seizing the land of the indigenous population, and thereby settling that land with Europeans crossing the Atlantic and stocking that land with the bodies of enslaved Africans. I draw an analogy between 1776 and other settler revolts, which I would say are inherently problematic. For example, November 1965, in what was then called Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe, where a European minority led by Ian Smith thought that London was moving towards African majority rule. And rather than accede to that decision, in their own words, they decided to emulate 1776 by revolting against the crown. Or, for example, consider the settlers' revolt in Algeria in the late 1950s, which almost toppled the regime in Paris, that is to say, the colonial master overall.
Right.
So obviously we need a different and new analysis of this country now known as the United States of America in light of the election of Donald J. Trump, which it seems to me calls for an agonizing reappraisal of how we've reached the brink of disaster.
I guess after having read this book over the past week, I'm curious to know what convinced you to write a scholarly text that placed enslaved Africans at the forefront of the revolution, or causing the revolution against the against Great Britain?
Well, first of all, you should also know that just in the last few days, a companion volume of mine has dropped. I'm speaking of The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean, where I take the story back to the 1600s. Once again, I think it's important to point out that property in enslaved Africans not only represented a major capital investment, for example, on the brink of the U.S. Civil War circa 1860, property in the slave Africans in the South, was the most lucrative investment. But this was also a rebellious labor force, which oftentimes sought to ally with the foes of the settlers to overthrow their rule. By the way, this took place in what is now Haiti, 1791 to 1804. The enslaved Africans rebelled against French rule, and throughout the slave-owning class, many of whom migrants to Savannah, to Charleston, to Norfolk. So this idea of enslaved rebelling was not imaginary. And in fact, if you understand not only the rebelliousness of Africans, but also the fact that they oftentimes allied with the indigenous population, the Native American population, making them even more troublesome, you have the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which spoke of a wealth to say you all were citizenry on guard against rebellion by indigenous and Africans. And then, of course, that Second Amendment is now coming back to haunt this country. As Fort Lauderdale, Florida, have just exemplified. Mm-hmm. But that also exemplifies is that it seems to people in the United States, they would prefer clean to the these mid-limey realities of how this country was founded. As a result, people will continue to die, I'm afraid.
I think one motif that I found interesting throughout the book was the growing number of enslaved Africans reaching the North American mainland, and slave owning population, the colonists being afraid of slave uprisings. And it seems to me that if you know bringing in more people to your area is going to potentially cause more rebellions, why keep doing it?
Well, in a word, profit. I mean, right. People were taking a risk. I mean, capitalism is based upon risk. I mean, for example, I mean, in 1990, if somebody had asked you to throw seed capital at Larry Page and those who founded Google, you right. might have said, I don't know, you know, this concept doesn't make any sense to me. That's the more civilized expression of risk. In the 1600s and the 1700s, we're talking about whether or not one could invest $1 in a slave trading enterprise and profit by taking home $1,700. Mm-hmm. Now, there are those who would sell their firstborn for 1,700% profit. And I think it's easy to explain why people would take the risk, because they were drunk on the prospect of profiting. Just like, for example, I'm sure where you are sitting, perhaps even outside your door, there may be people who think the better part of wisdom is to invest in what are called illegal drugs, and because of profit, even though they run the risk of spending a couple of decades behind bars. I mean, you know, this is how this society works, right. And how it has worked for decades.
Right. I guess the main reason I ask that, because it becomes pretty apparent when, you know, the United States is actually becomes a nation. The country enacts, you know, for example, the Naturalization Act of 1790, in which they try to, you know, bring in more whites into the country.
Or people defined as white would be.
People defined as white, right, into the country. And it's almost as if such an act would such an act would suggest that, hey, we got a little ahead of ourselves, you know, bringing all these Africans here. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy for thinking that, but.
Well, actually, if you think about it, in the cold light of history, as of 2018, that gamble worked because bringing in more people defined as white helped to overawe and overcome the indigenous population and the enslaved African population. And of course, the experiment exploded and crashed and burned in 1861 with the U.S. Civil War, which led to tens of thousands of people dying. But I guess some might say that that's the price one pays. And I should also say that the reason I say people defined as white, because in my book on the 1600s, I talk about the prelude to this new identity politics of whiteness, which was the religious conflict, which you see even today in Northern Ireland in terms of Protestant versus Catholic, which had led to religious wars, particularly the 30 Years' War, concluding in 1648. And as the 30 Years' War concludes, and as people are tallying up the body count, simultaneously what's happening is this move across the Atlantic, particularly to the Caribbean, Barbados and Jamaica, for example, which up until the mid-18th century, London saw as more valuable than the North American mainland. But it was apparent that this politics of religious identity would not be sufficient, not least, in terms of subduing and subjugating indigenous populations and then African populations. So you needed a new identity politics, and thereby you saw the move to expand identity from religion to race. That is to say, Europeans from the Atlantic Ocean to the Ural Mountains in Russia. And not only that, but even dipping southward, Ralph Nader, the presidential candidate in the year 2000, is of Lebanese Christian descent. He's defined as white.
Yes.
The leader of Uber, the car hailing service, is Iranian. As far as I know, he's defined as white. So this whole question of what might be called white identity politics has just reared its ugly head in November 2016, because what happened was that over decades, you had the property value devalued. You had it devalued in part because what happened in Arkansas with the Little Rock desegregation school battle, whereby black children were allowed to go to school with children defined as white, which was seen as an outrage, which led to rebellions. But those rebellions by folks defined as white in some ways was a rebellion against the devaluation of whiteness, which would mean that they would have to compete. For example, I oftentimes use the example of Pete Gray. If you go to Google Images and put Pete Gray, St. Louis Browns, so you'll find an image of a armed outfielder in the 1940s, before the era of Jackie Robinson. After Jackie Robinson and the black folks and the Latinos began to integrate Major League Baseball, there was less of a need for one-armed outfielders defined as white. And so there was a progressive devaluation of whiteness, not least because of international pressure. And finally, what happens in November 2016, after suffering the quote indignity, unquote, of having a president of African descent, Kenyan descent, from 2008 to 2016, and faced with the prospect of then having a woman president in 2016, there was this mass rebellion at the polls and electing a buffoon, a con man, a man who bids fair to send this entire planet down in flames as the U.S. president. But all of this begins in the 1600s. And I should also say that I'm not planning a book on the 1500s to give this more sustenance.
Nice, nice. There was, I don't think you talked about this a lot in the counter-revolution of 1776, but I was very interested in how, I guess, what would be later considered white people. I'm curious to know as to how working class white people coming over in the 18th century, how they could in any way be pro-slavery. It would seem to undermine their potential for livelihood.
Well, that's like asking why some of these people voted for Trump. I guess, they're making a gamble. They're making a bargain. I mean, you could say that, this tax bill of December 2017 is not going to benefit them. But perhaps they think that as they look at the history of settlement in North America, that it has been a class collaboration between poor and richer Europeans. And ultimately, one can make an argument that the poor Europeans profited when the Native Americans were ousted from their land. Mm-hmm. And say, per the Homestead Act of 1862, for example, the land was then doled out to Europeans. So it's interesting to note as well that in 1733, London had grasped what you're suggesting. That's when they decided to form a colony, now known as Georgia, where there would be no Negroes allowed, only Europeans. But as the 2010 census suggests, whereby Georgia now has a black population larger than any other state in these United States of America, that experiment didn't work out very well.
Indeed.
It didn't work out very well. Mm-hmm. Not least because by barring Africans, you were increasing class contradictions between and amongst poor and richer Europeans. Mm-hmm. Because that meant that the poor Europeans had to do the work that the Negroes would have to do. And that was recreating the tensions and conflicts of Europe. It reminds me, last summer, I was doing research in Moscow, Idaho, the home of the University of Idaho, on a book I'm doing on jazz. And for the first time in North America, and I've traveled throughout these 50 states, including Hawaii, I had Euro-American men who were making my bed. And usually, of course, when you go to a hotel, it's a black woman or it's a Latina, increasingly the latter.
Yes.
But because the folks in Idaho, 1.7 million strong, are not necessarily immigrant friendly, somebody got to make up these beds in the hotels. And so the work devolves to these men to find white. Now, thus far, I guess that system has worked out very well. But in terms of, they don't seem to be organizing unions and and doing the things that workers tend to do. But to get to the nub of your question, it was a gamble. That is to say, you could bring over enslaved Africans and run the risk that they would rebel and cut your throat in the middle of the night. Or you could keep them out, and then you would perhaps be turning your back against humongous profits. Those were a few of the choices.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of years ago reading about just some 19th century political campaign ads directed at poor white people. And I remember seeing this one illustration talking about how horrible life was for these, downtrodden white folks. But at the end of the message, it reminded them that, hey, at least you're not black.
Even with the devaluation of whiteness sitting in Arkansas, I'm sure you must realize that there are certain privileges still attached to having a color devoid epidermis, to put it in another way.
Indeed.
And the question is, however, how long will that last?
That's a good question. I kind of want to move on to the Caribbean, and I want to make a Caribbean versus mainland North America comparison in terms of the enslaved. When I was younger, I studied abroad in Jamaica. And, you know, if you've ever been in Jamaica, you've seen their currency. They have, you know, their national heroes on their currency. People like Marcus Garvey, Norman Manley. But there was one person that I saw on Jamaica's currency that, me as an African-American, I wasn't familiar with, but it was Queen Nanny of the Maroons. And I learned the history about how she and her group ended up having a peace treaty with the British that they were fighting, I believe in the 18th century. And they ended up becoming pretty much an autonomous group in the country. I guess I'm curious to know, how come one doesn't hear about, say, maroonish or maroon-like groups in the United States the way that one does, say, in maybe in a Brazil or Central America or the Caribbean?
Well, they did exist.
Okay.
Of course, the short answer to your question is that a good deal of the history of the United States has been whitewashed. I mean, you have scholars writing today who downplay and dismiss the idea of slave rebelliousness in these United States of America. However, if you go to your search engine and type in Great Dismal Swamp, which is on the border between North Carolina and Virginia, you will find numerous references to Maroons. In fact, the historian Herbert Aptheker wrote about that as early as the 1930s.
Okay.
If you look at the history of Florida, and by the way, my new study that I'm conceptualizing on the 1500s would probably begin in Florida, despite the fact that the Anglo-centric model that governs the history of North America, which suggests that enslaved Africans arrived in Virginia for the first time in 1619.
Mm-hmm.
And said next year there'll be all of these celebrations or ceremonies or whatever, marking the 400th anniversary. And I have to say that even though I know better, I'm going to participate in them. The fact is that you had Africans in Florida as early as the 1500s. I mean, it was under Spanish rule, of course.
Mm-hmm.
St. Augustine, Florida, was founded in 1565. There were enslaved Africans in St. Augustine, Florida in 1565. And what you'll find is that historically in Florida, you had Maroon populations. And in fact, to skip ahead a few centuries to the U.S. period, which begins circa 1820, when the United States ousts Spain from Florida and takes over, and now controls what is now the third largest state in the United States of America, speaking of Florida,
mm-hmm.
You had a number of wars.
The Seminole Wars.
Bitter, brutal, violent
yeah.
wars involving the indigenous population we refer to as the Seminoles,
right.
who had merged with the enslaved African populations. In fact, if you look at my book, Negro Comrades of the Crown,
mm-hmm.
African Americans of the British Empire Fight the United States Before Emancipation, the book starts in 1815 in Florida, when not only are the Africans and the indigenous armed to the teeth, unlike Africans for the last 200 years, and were under the British flag, by the way. They were allied with the British. And Andrew Jackson, who I'm sure you carry pictures of him wherever you go, he made his reputation by destroying what was called the Negro Fort in North Florida, what is now North Florida. Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of history in this country that is little known or not known, because there has been this conscious attempt to present this sanitized version of the history of the United States. And in fact, if I can fast forward, if you look at this morning's New York Times, there's a very interesting op-ed piece by two scholars. One is named Meaning, the other is named Wertheim. And they're criticizing the liberal critics of Donald Trump for suggesting that he's breaking with past policy with regard to U.S. foreign policy. And according to these critics, Meany and Wertheim, they say, no, he's actually continuing the past policy, just albeit in a more radical direction. He's just deepening what has already existed. As a matter of fact, this is the term that appears in the New York Times. It's rather shocking to see it appear. They call Trump, quote, a radical imperialist, unquote. And that's the kind of lingo I use. I was very surprised to read it in the New York Times, but what I'm citing that article for is the proposition that we've been fed this sort of namby-pamby version of the history of North America, which has left us totally unprepared and ill-prepared to deal with the ugly realities of 2018.
I completely agree. I guess I want to flash forward to the war with the Metropole, the colonist war with Great Britain. Toward the end of the book, Washington is compelled to allow free Africans into the Continental Army, or not, maybe not Continental, but a militia force, I should say. And again, I'm baffled because what would convince a free African man to fight for the rebels? Please tell me. I really want to know.
Well, first of all, there's propaganda. I mean, you know, he might have thought he was fighting for, quote, liberty, unquote, and freedom, unquote. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very difficult to say, hey, guess what? We're fighting so we can enslave more Africans and take more Native Americans' land. That's not a winning slogan. Any PR person could tell you that that's not a winning slogan. That's not a way to attract folks to your banner. So you speak in high-minded terms. Secondly, I mean, look around you today. I mean, look on the U.S. Supreme Court with Clarence Thomas, for example, who repeatedly makes decisions that go against the interests of black people. That's because he's pursuing what he considers to be his class and ideological interests. And keep in mind that in terms of the history of the United States, for a while, for example, you had black slave owners in Charleston, South Carolina. For a while, you had Negro slave owners in New Orleans, for example. And so these folks might have thought it was in their class interest to fight to defeat London. But as we all know, oftentimes people miscalculate what their true interests are. They do not have a kaleidoscopic vision of the correlation of forces. And so therefore they make blunders and boners and mistakes. And I would say that's certainly true for the Negro who fought alongside George Washington.
I know in the book you seem to suggest that, I guess, the progeny of those Africans who ended up having to stay in those 13 colonies are almost kind of, you seem to suggest paying a price for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And could you elaborate on that?
So look, historians have known for decades, if not centuries, that by several orders of magnitude, the Africans were pro-London during George Washington's war. And when you are perceived as being on the losing side of a war, you can be expected to pay a heavy price, not only you, but your descendants, forevermore, unless and until you can turn the tables. And what happened is, with the Haitian Revolution, we began to see the turning of the tables. However, it's still fair to say that black people are being punished not only for being on the, quote, wrong side, unquote, of the war that created the United States of America, but also because at an early stage in the settlement of North America, African was equated with slave, and you treat slaves with contempt. In fact, recent scholarship has shown, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Save the Tiger with Jack Lemmon, about how this factory owner burns down his factory in order to get the insurance money. Well, enslaved Africans were insured. And so at a certain point, if you killed this enslaved African, you could profit by getting the insurance money. Third, one of the largest uncompensated expropriations in history took place in 1865 when billions of dollars in slave property, including in Arkansas, by the way, were expropriated from the slave owners without the slave owners being compensated. Now, when I do this in a class, I usually go up to a student who's fiddling with their smartphone and not listening to me. And I take the smartphone from their hands and say, I've just expropriated your property without compensation. You don't feel very good about that, do you? You feel angry. You feel furious. You probably want to take me outside and thrash me. Well, that's how the slave owners felt in 1865. When what they had thought to be a horse or a cow was taken from them without compensation and then elevated to their level as they saw things. And then the fourth point is that the Negroes, oftentimes allied, as noted, with the antagonists of the settlers, be they Native Americans or Haitians or British. I just published a book a few weeks ago, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity. The keystone of that book takes place in November 1942, when Negroes in East St. Louis, Illinois, just up the Mississippi River from you, by the way, are engaged in military drills with arms. November 1942, mind you, within the lifetime of many folks still living in Arkansas.
Yes.
Who these Negroes were engaged in military drills in anticipation of a Japanese invasion of North America that they were going to join on the side of the Japanese. Now, this was a reaction to the pogrom launched against the Negroes in 1917 in East St. Louis, where they were burned at the stake, disemboweled, lynched, tortured, murdered en masse. So they were not going to have that again. So they were going to join the Japanese in terms of overthrowing the government. This was nothing new. However, the flip side of that is that when you combine this with the other factors that I've mentioned, that you were not in favor of the 1776 war, that you came from a class of individuals, Africans, who were equated with slaves, which meant you were going to be treated with derision and contempt, when you as property were taken from slave masters without compensation in 1865, infuriating the slave masters, and then cap it all off, you're joining with antagonists like Japan in November 1942 to help to overthrow the government. It's no surprise, given that you have a disproportionate number of black people on death row, including in your own Arkansas, that you have the Department of Housing and Urban Development, headed by Dr. Ben Carson in Washington, D.C., just issued a report saying that of the homeless population, 40% is black, even though blacks are 12.5 to 13% of the population. And if you go to the capital of homelessness, which is Los Angeles,
yes,
where the black population of the state of California is 7%, but the homeless population on Skid Row in L.A. is almost all black.
Yeah,
I would argue that this is a product of the accumulation of history, which has now congealed into a bitter and ugly reality.
One thing I wanted to ask you was about, I guess, the Africans' form of rebellion. Can you name some, give me some methods in terms of how the enslaved resisted?
Well, of course, there is murder, strangling your slave masters in the middle of the night in their beds. There's poisons. I talk about that in length in the 1776 book, by the way.
Right.
If you're preparing the food to poison the food, there's arson, for example, burning the house down, burning down the fields. There are all sorts of methods of resist. There's malingering in the fields. Not work hard because, you know, you're not getting the fruits of your labor. So why should you work hard to profit and benefit somebody else?
Okay.
Yes, those were just some of the tools of resistance.
Yeah. I'm curious about taking people from one part of the world and bringing them to a new world and getting them to work. And it seems to me, and I don't feel like a lot of people really think about this when they think of slavery, is it seems to me, to some extent, you would have to be taking skilled labor from some places.
Yes.
In order to, benefit from the, say, the crops you're growing, for example. Yes. You may take people from, say, a rice-growing region of West Africa, put them in a area in the New World that's ripe for growing rice, and utilize those people's skills to help, to help you profit.
Well, yes. There is a book called Black Rice by a UCLA historian that makes that precise point.
Right.
With regard to taking Africans from a certain part of West Africa where there's rice growing, and taking them to South Carolina. And, of course, on the one hand, you have slave traders who would just go willy-nilly into Africa, and with the maniacal energy of crazed bees would handcuff and manacle every African in sight and throw them on a slave ship. Then you had slave traders who were much more targeted and precise. They would look for Africans with certain skills, for example. Mm-hmm. It would be as if China, in some sort of science fiction, would come to the west coast of North America. And, they say, look, I think we're going to avoid Compton and South Central Los Angeles, and we're going to go to Silicon Valley and snatch all the engineers. And then we'll sail up the coast to Seattle and go into the Amazon and Microsoft building and snatch everybody there. And then sail across the Pacific and put these people to work in China. Well, in some senses, that's what happened with regard to people sailing from the Atlantic coast of North America into Africa. Not only West Africa, but some of my research has shown East Africa as well.
I really don't hear much about East Africa, such as what countries in East Africa?
Oh, Mozambique.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay.
For example, it's known, first of all, Zanzibar, which is part of Tanzania now, it's off the southeastern coast of Africa, was once the Kmart, or to put it in your terms, the Walmart of the African slave trade. And the U.S. slave traders were the preeminent force in Zanzibar as early as the 1840s, for example. I'm sure, that with the Dutch settlement in the Cape of Good Hope in 1652, the Dutch, of course, began to enslave Mozambicans, and in fact, even went to their other colony, which is now Indonesia, and would bring those people to the Cape to be enslaved as well. So this whole process of enslavement is one of the ugliest chapters in world history. And by the way, perhaps a sad note to conclude on is that slavery persists. By some estimates, there are more slaves now than there were at the height of the African slave trade in the middle of the 19th century. And of course, I'm sure you've heard the stories about bonded laborers in factories in Los Angeles, oftentimes Thai and Southeast Asian workers, who are sort of enslaved. I mean, they're kept there, they're not allowed to leave. And you only hear about them once a fire goes through the factory and they're all entrapped and die. So we have a lot of work ahead of us in order to make this planet a better place and to save it from the depredations that Donald J. Trump has in store for most of us.
All right. Well, I will not keep you any longer. I appreciate the history lesson. I definitely enjoyed the book.
Look at my other books.
I will. I was taking copious notes.
Especially the Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism in the 1600s.
Okay. Dr. Harn, I want to thank you for your time. and maybe we can do this again sometime if you have the time.
Oh, sure. Send me the link.
All right. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.